You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. If you are listening to the podcast of this, it is located at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. Please consider becoming a patron. As well, there are two publishing houses, SteinerBooks.org in America and RudolfSteinerPress.com in England, who are the sole publishers of Steiner into English and have given me permission to do these recordings. Please consider patronizing them as well. This is a reading of Collected Works, Volume 282 by Rudolf Steiner, entitled Speech and Drama, 19 Lectures, a Cycle, translated by Mary Adams. This is Lecture 12, entitled The Artistic Quality in Drama, Stylization of Moods, given on the 16th of September, 1924. My dear friends, today we will begin with the recitation of a scene where we can trace the workings of a conscious endeavor on the part of the dramatist to bring style into drama. I will say only a few words in preparation, for you will find that the scene itself will show you how a real poet, in the best sense of the word, relates himself to this question of style, how he deals with it in practice. Schiller's early plays were, as we know, not characterized by style. Die Räuber, certainly not. But neither can Fisco nor Kubala, no, nor even Don Carlos, be said to have attained to style. Then, for a while, Schiller's creative powers in that direction were exhausted, and he had to devote himself to other activities. And it was during this time that his relations with Goethe underwent a change. It is not too much to say that having seen what Goethe's genius could create, Schiller took this work of Goethe's as the foundation for a further development of his own artistic ideal. Goethe's dramas became for him a kind of school at which he studied and prepared himself for new activity in the same field. We can follow the process, step by step, in the interchange of letters between the two poets, and in the records of their conversations. Nor need we be surprised that Schiller, who saw in Goethe the artist par excellence, should take him for his pattern. The Goethe who had created an Iphigenia and a Tasso, dramas where the language reaches a high level of style. Not that Schiller had any thought of letting drama develop exclusively in the direction of style and speech. He was naturally concerned for the totality of dramatic art. But from this time on, he devoted his best effort to the attainment of style. We can see it already in Wallenstein and in the later dramas in Maria Stuart, in Die Braut von Messina, in Die Jungfrau von Orleans. We find him concentrating more and more on the development of style in some aspect or another. In Maria Stuart, from which our scene is taken, we have an attempt to develop a style that is different from that of titled Die Braut von Messina, a style namely in the treatment of mood. For what is so striking in this scene is the successive moods that pervade the different scenes. The moods are, of course, evoked by the characters, especially by the prominent part taken in the play by two such antagonistic characters as Mary, Queen of Scots herself, and Queen Elizabeth. But altogether, the drama runs its course, fundamentally speaking, in moods. We can even say that the characters live out their parts in moods. You need only study a few of these individually to see how they pass through mood after mood as the situation changes. Take the momentous scene that Frau Dr. Steiner will presently read to us, a scene that is outstandingly characteristic of the whole play. You have here an excellent example of stylized mood. There is, to begin with, the mood that can be observed in Mary herself, and that plays no small part also in the drama as a whole. The mood that arises from the fact that Mary is at first committed to the charge of a kindly inclined jailer, but comes later into the custody of one who is rigid in the discharge of his duties. And then we have all that happens as a result of the change. The mood is still at work in this remarkable scene, that is so teeming with interest and incident, and we shall be able to watch how the characters of Mary and Elizabeth unfold under its influence. the characters also of others who are present. I draw your attention to this because I want you to see how earnest Schiller is in his striving for style. After Wallenstein, he sets out, in fact, to give each play style in a different way. Of the significance of this for the actor, I will speak later, after you have listened to the scene. Let it suffice now to point out that in Titel Maria Stuart it is moods that are stylized, whereas Titel in Die Jungfrau von Orleans it is events. The successive events come before us there in truly grand style. And then in Titel Wilhelm Tell we have a stylizing of character. Schiller attains in this play to what may verily be called a painting of the human soul. In Titel Die Braut von Messina we find him endeavoring to follow Goethe as closely as possible by developing style in the inner form and picture of the stage. Lastly, he sets out with the intention of giving style to the whole interworking of men and events. That was in his title Demetrius, which he did not live to finish. So, now we will ask you to listen to the scene in Schiller's Maria Stuart, which portrays the development of the situation to which I have alluded. And now Frau Steiner reads this. It's quite long. So I'm going through here the German and then the English translation. Again, you'll need to get the book or Rudolf Steiner archive to see this. And then I'm back to Dr. Steiner again. And now, my dear friends, if we take such a work as Maria Stuart and consider it as an example of a drama that owes its creation to a definite artistic resolve, the question may well present itself. How is the actor to find his right relation to a play of this kind? This we have now to consider, and we shall expect to find here again specific laws upon which the actor can base his endeavors. In some dramas, we can see quite clearly, when we look into the question of their origin, that it is the theme, the plot with its characters, that has inspired the dramatist to write his drama. This was true more or less of Schiller when, as a young man, he set himself to compose Titel Die Räuber. All through the play we can see that what interests him is the subject matter in the widest sense of the word. He's attracted by the event and the characters that take part in it. He wants to make poetry of them. The same can be said even of Goethe in one period of his life. At the time when he was beginning to compose Faust, he was writing also titled Götz von Berlichingen. His main interest was in the plot and the characters. Faust is a character that interests him intensely. And then, what a Faust can experience, that too has a great attraction for him. And in Götz von Berlichingen, it is in the first place the hero himself. And then, the time in which he lived. These two themes were of lively interest to Goethe. But now look at Schiller embarking upon his Maria Stuart. We have here quite another situation. Maria Stuart is the result of a conscious endeavor on Schiller's part to be an artist in the realm of drama. His whole desire is to compose plays that shall be artistic. And he looks round for material to serve his purpose. He looks for a material that will lend itself to the style he wants to develop. His starting point was by no means the story of Mary, Queen of Scots. He sets out in search of a theme upon which he can successfully create a drama where it shall be the moods that give style to the piece. Now, the initial purpose of the dramatist is of no little significance for the actor. And if we are making plans for a school of dramatic art, we ought certainly to arrange that both kinds of drama are studied. The students should practice with dramas where the poet's interest lies mainly in the plot. Such a drama, for instance, as title Götz von Berlichingen or title Die Räuber. And they should work also with dramas like title Maria Stuart, title Die Jungfrau von Orleans, title Die Braut von Messina or title Wilhelm Tell. And while the students are studying in this way the different dramatic styles, that will also be the moment for them to pass from a study that concerns itself purely with acting to a study that, instead of merely asking all the time, how are we to do this, how are we to do that, takes rather for its theme the entire play itself as a work of art. I will give you an example. William Tell is a play that provides excellent opportunity for an actor to develop style in his work by studying the style of the piece. But it should be made clear to the student that in this play, Schiller's style comes to grief in many places. The fact will be forcibly brought home to you if you should ever happen to hear some orthodox professor of literature interpreting one of the scenes in a way that may possibly accord with the illusions of a professor who has more credulity than discernment, but does not at all accord with real life. Quote, "What a wonderful scene that is," close quote, you might hear him say to his pupils, quote, where Tell declines to attend the meetings the others are holding, declaring that he is a man of deeds and not of words, and that he will leave it to them to do the talking, and hold himself ready to be called on when the moment for action has come. Close quote. I did once hear a credulous professor speak in this way to a still more credulous audience of both young and old. And then, all too easily, such a view becomes the accepted interpretation and is handed down and repeated as if it were an indisputable truth. And we can see it spreading like a disease through the schools, and indeed wherever it has a chance to push its way in. No one stops to ask, but is it possible that Tell should speak like that? For it certainly is not possible. True, Tell had the character that Schiller means to give him. He was not a man of many words. You would not find him taking a front seat in the meetings and making grandiloquent speeches. But he would be there. He would be sitting at the back and listening. Tell was not the kind of man to boast that he let the others do the talking, and wanted only to be called on when it was time for action, which would give the impression that he had himself no idea as to what ought to be done. It is simply not true. The way Schiller makes Tell speak in that passage, and the student has here a good opportunity of learning to judge for himself without bias. And that is supremely important where art is concerned. What Schiller has done in this passage is to push the stylization too far. Then it can become routine, which it must never do. It must always have life. And now, let us suppose the actor or the student takes a drama of the one or the other kind as subject for his study. How will he proceed with a drama like Die Räuber or Don Carlos, or, on the other hand, with a drama like Maria Stuart or Die Braut von Messina? For a drama of the first kind, the right course will be to work only for a shorter time at the development of mime and gesture, whilst another does the reciting, and to lead over quite soon to simultaneous speaking and acting. There must, of course, always be, first, the practice in gesture to the accompaniment of a reciter, but in this case not for long. The student should, as soon as possible, unite the gesturing with the spoken word. With a drama of the second kind, the actor or student will require to practice the silent gesture and mime with a reciter speaking the words for him for a much longer period. He should indeed defer till as late as possible the union in his own person of gesture and word. By following this method, he will attain a result which there is no need to attain in the former type of drama, and which could even, perhaps, be detrimental there to the performance of his art. I mean the following. The gesture, having through long practice come to rest, as it were, in the actor, continues to be present there in him and cooperates in the forming of the word. The actor, of course, meanwhile quite unconscious of the process. It happens instinctively as far as he is concerned. And if we want to stage a drama that is first and foremost in its whole intention a work of art, then we have to make sure that all through our study of it, we succeed in uniting the art of the acting with the art, the poetry, that is in the play itself. Only then will the art of the acting make its right contact with the audience, and upon that, after all, everything depends. The audience will not easily be brought into a mood that grips them in their very soul, if we put before them a realistic scene, which is, in addition, realistically acted. It is quite possible to fascinate people with a realistic scene, so that, for the moment, they give their whole attention, But if we sincerely want to reach our audience, there can be no better way than by lifting them right out of naturalistic experience and taking them up to the level of art. Let us take now the scene that has been read to us and imagine we have to consult together how we shall proceed to stage it, giving our attention first to the question of scenic effect. How shall we create the right environment for the words that are spoken in this scene? To build up a decor from a naturalistic point of view, to paint, let us say, a forest as naturalistically as possible, would most certainly not achieve our object. For could anyone imagine that such a scene as this, parenthesis, the scene ends, you will remember, in a manner that is directly contrary to the will of everyone present, takes them one and all by surprise, close parenthesis, could anyone imagine that the motif of the scene could be rendered with style if we set out to surround it with the mood of a forest? The one and only thing to do is let the surroundings of the scene present by your artistic treatment of them the mood that belongs to this juncture in the play. I must here allude to a request that has been handed me in writing, asking if I would add a little more to what I said the other day about the painting of stage scenery. But, my dear friend, so far as my memory goes, I have not spoken at all on this subject. What I said then was in reference to landscape painting. We were considering the character of art in general and took landscape painting for our example. I do not like to be misunderstood in this way. I have up to now said nothing whatever about painting for the stage. As a matter of fact, the very first thing you must realize in this connection is that for stage decor, painting as an art does not come into question. We have to rely on our equipment for stage lighting to do the painting for us. To return to the scene from Maria Stuart, our main concern should be that the speakers have around them the mood of the scene, with all the successive changes it undergoes. Now, in the matter of moods, there is bound to be always some difference of opinion. But I think no one will find it seriously discordant if we propose to arrange for the whole stage to be suffused during the scene with a reddish lighting. The color will naturally have to change a little as the scene goes on, but can always keep a fundamental reddish tone. At the end of the scene, where Mary speaks so sharply, the reddish tone can, as it were, pierce inward into itself and become dazzling yellow. There will also be not a few other modifications here and there. For example, right at the beginning of the scene, where Mary is in a thoroughly sentimental vein, you can introduce into the general reddish mood a bluish-violet mood. That, then, will be your first question settled. And now, how are you going to see that your wings and backdrop make their right contribution to the mood of the scene? Impossible to have there a realistically painted picture of a bit of forest. Trees, however, you must have. And what about their color? The scene demands that the coloring of the trees shall harmonize with the mood of the lighting. You cannot paint into a red mood trees that are absolutely green. You will have to introduce a touch of red into their color. And in order to provide something on which the eye can rest when Mary grows sarcastic, you can take yellow also onto your palette. I should rather say onto your brush, for one should never paint from a palette, but always with watercolors. Then the actors will have around them a true picture of the mood of the scene. And it will be the same with all your arrangements for the staging of the play. When you come to the question of costume, you must realize that it is of no use to set about inventing all manner of fancy dresses, which only make the wearers look queer and awkward. That is not the way to attain style. Costumes should be cut to suit the wearers, and, it is in the color that you will have to let style come in. In the choice of color, in the harmony of the colors worn by different parts. And here one will not be so childish as to snatch at the first idea that offers, which would naturally mean, in this case, that Mary should wear black. Black should appear on the stage only in the rare cases where it is justified from an artistic point of view. As a matter of fact, on the stage, black obliterates itself, makes a void. Devils or beings of such ilk we can allow to appear in black. But we ought never to think of using black for any other purpose. Mary will have to be dressed in dark violet. Her color should be chosen first. For the achievement of style, it is always important to know where to begin. Then, with Mary in violet, you cannot do otherwise than choose for Elizabeth a dress of reddish-yellowish color, and the colors of the other characters will be gradually shaded as taste requires. Working in this way, you will get your picture, and you will see your audience will understand it. Provided it has been faithfully built up on these lines, the picture will make its appeal. For how is it that the actor of today finds it so difficult to carry his audience with him? Simply because we are not sufficiently in earnest about this question of style. We want to attain style, but we do not set about it seriously enough. We ought not really to complain so much of the audience. It is never the audience who are to blame. It is the art itself that is wanting. But, my dear friends, how can we expect to achieve art if behind the founding of our theatres lie impulses and motives such as are disclosed in the following well-authenticated incident? A big theatre was once started in a town by a journalist who was also a playwright, and who took on himself the direction of the theatre. It was named after a distinguished classical author. Externally, you see, the founder was trying to do the thing in style. Arrangements were also made for a speech to be given at the opening ceremony, in which very fine things were said about this author, and about the splendid future that the theater would have if it followed in his footsteps. For he had himself been eminent in the art of the stage, and had laid down many golden rules for its practice. If now a true devotion to art, in the highest sense, had begun to manifest in the work of that theater, naturally, fare of a lighter kind being offered also, now and again, in deference to public taste. It might have been in quite good style to open the theatre with a speech of this kind. But style has to be something inward. It has to be livingly experienced. And I would ask you now to judge for yourselves whether there really was style in the enterprise when I tell you what took place immediately after the official opening, despite the high-sounding words that had been spoken by the director. There had, of course, been other speeches, too, including one by the chairman of the theatre committee, who spoke in becoming terms of the director, and so on, and so on. Yes, there was style in the opening ceremony, but of what kind? There was no life in it, as all too quickly became apparent. For what happened when the function was over and the audience had dispersed? Among the people around such a director, there will generally be some who are sincere idealists. Not many, but there will be a few. One such, or perhaps only a semi-idealist, went up to the director and said, "I wish you all success. Running your theatre in the way you have described, you will be helping to revive and restore art." To which the director replied, "But it's the profits I'm after." Yes, you see how it is. The style of which the opening ceremony gave promise has all crumbled to dust. It was not in the man's heart, not in his inner being. Style has, in fact, become in our day something which people no longer feel in life. They are insensitive to it. And that is why I find it so important to impress upon you that he alone can hope to achieve style in art who sets out in all seriousness to live in it. The end of Lecture 12.